Hello and welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. I'm your host, Bulelani Nonyokela. It's been 64 years since the Sharpeville massacre, a moment that shaped the country's fight for justice. But time and again, state violence continues to cast a long shadow. In this episode, we'll explore the intersections of protest, power, policing, and accountability in modern-day South Africa. We'll hear from three voices. First, I'll talk with Shenila Mohammed, Executive Director of Amnesty International South Africa, about human rights and state violence. Then I'll speak with Gareth Newham, a policing expert from the Institute for Security Studies, to discuss the evolution of South African law enforcement. And finally, I'll be joined by activist and political analyst Dale McKinley to dive into the links between state violence, economic power, and inequality.
Terrible things are happening in South Africa. The leadership is doing some terrible things.
We will not be bullied.
Let the gold mirror to US. We're not just beggars.
The president did want them to say, if you're going to fire, we'll take it as a declaration of war.
I can't be threatened by Zuma. I defeated Zuma.
You're dealing with Jacob Zuma. Every stage is a theater for him.
We're not sending help to criminals. We're going to smoke them out. They will come out.
There has not been agreement in terms of parties in the executive.
The executive must come here.
The people of Palestine, they're denied the right to enjoy the freedoms we so love.
So social protest has long been a tool for social change, but what happens when those who protest are met with violence from the state? How does this impact on human rights, democracy, and civil society? We'll now be speaking to Shenila Mohammed, the Executive Director of Amnesty International South Africa, to dive deeper into the human rights implication of state violence and how it affects activists and marginalized communities. Shenila, thank you so much for joining me. Amnesty International has been advocating for human rights. How would you describe or assess the current political climate for protesters in the country? Is there maybe an erosion of civil liberties?
So thank you for having me. I think the situation in South Africa in particular, and globally actually, is a closing of civic space. You know, what we're seeing is that particularly around protest action, you know, protesters are facing all sorts of possibilities of excessive use of force by the police. And it's not a safe place, despite the fact that, you know, many protest actions are governed by permission that they receive from the police before they actually start. But I think what's happening is that protest action is now being seen as a civil right that needs to be clamped down on. And it's a way of silencing people who are fighting for their basic rights.
Yeah. What international human rights obligation does South Africa have? And has the government been actually living up to them when it comes to policing protests?
Well, I think that, you know, what's important to know is that, you know, the way in which it's governed under local law as well as international law is that, you know, the police does have some leeway, okay? Mm. Even in the constitution in South Africa, you know, in the Criminal Procedures Act number 51 of 1977, I mean, it says that police can use some force, but it's very specific as to when it can use it. And I think that, you know, what's happening now is that the police is using this force randomly. So I'll give you an example. Yeah. Police in South Africa love to use rubber bullets. Now, those things are extremely dangerous. You know, there's this perception out there that rubber bullets are safe. There's no such thing as safe weapons. Mm. So rubber bullets can cause massive damage. People have had their eyes taken out by these. People have died because of rubber bullets. And I think that there are specific rules that govern when the police can and should use these. Now, for example, the police cannot fire rubber bullets randomly in a crowd, which is what the police here do. And, you know, they're supposed to see where the issue is, where the protest is becoming violent or whatever, and use that proportionately. But yet what we see in South Africa is that there's a disproportionate use of this type of non-fatal sort of weapons. Mm. And I think the challenge is that the police are actually not trained properly. in how to manage public order. And that is where our big challenge lies. I think the police need to undergo proper training, but also when there are violations, they need to actually be held to account. I mean, IPED, the organization that looks at police behavior, themselves have spoken to the fact that there's over 3,500 cases a year where the police have used excessive force on citizens. And yet, you know, we don't see these numbers decreasing. So I think one of the things is that the police themselves get into a state of panic when there is a protest action that goes violent. And the first thing they do is they unleash these weapons and they unleash brutality. And I think the other thing is when you're watching it on TV, it actually looks like it's coming out of the apartheid era. And I think, unfortunately, we are seeing our police replicating some of that behavior that was used during apartheid, the apartheid era to, you know, to break down protesting and to break down activism.
Are there maybe international strategies or just strategies South Africa could adopt to better the rights of protesters?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing that the state has to do, because the state is the main, you know, where the accountability sits. But I think the state has firstly got to improve police training. They've got to make sure that the police officers, the public order police service, is properly trained to deal with public order, with the public, and deal when, you know, with protests that become violent, etc. I think the second thing is that, you know, they do have to, the public has to be raised, made aware of how to lodge a complaint. So if police use excessive force, if somebody goes, say, to complain and their excessive force is used against them, the public must always lodge a complaint, because there has to be action that has to be taken if we want our police to comply. And I think the public, members of the public also have to be educated on civil litigation. So if, for example, you know, the police have used excessive force during a protest action or a raid or, you know, stop and search operations, people need to understand that they have rights. You know, they don't need to be afraid. The police is not something we should be afraid of. They are there to protect us. They are not there to violate or abuse us.
And how does the violence affect the trust the citizens place in democratic institutions?
I think it affects the trust really badly. I think that, you know, a lot of people don't trust the police, which is why they don't go and complain. And I think that is really, in a country that has such high levels of crime, and in a country where, you know, we have a history of protest action, we have a history of fighting for our rights, I think that is actually a really unacceptable situation where the public does not trust the police. And I think the onus is on the police and on those, the people higher up, including the president, where, you know, the buck ends with him, to ensure that, you know, those that are responsible for these particular areas are making sure that not only are they building public trust, but they are also doing things the right way. They are properly trained in all of these things. And it does impact on people's basic human rights. You know, I mean, we've seen cases where people have gone to report certain crimes and they have been abused by the police. And I think that, you know, that's unacceptable. It should never, ever happen in a country like South Africa, which is a democratic state, which has a constitution that has a Bill of Rights that governs the basic human rights of all who live in South Africa.
Okay. Shanila, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
To understand the legacy of violence, we must look at how South African policing has evolved or failed to evolve since apartheid. We're now joined by Gareth Newham, a policing expert from the Institute for Security Studies, to examine how South African policing has changed since apartheid. Gareth, welcome. When we talk about policing in post-apartheid South Africa, many will point out to incidents like Marikana or student protest as evidence of a continuation of state violence. Do you think the police force has genuinely transformed since apartheid, or do we see old patterns resurfacing?
Well, I think when you look at sort of international police reform examples that are considered successful, South Africa usually is identified as one of those examples where an organization has undergone quite a significant reform process. So I don't think we can compare the South African Police Service of today with the South African police force during apartheid.
Mm.
Having said that, however, I think that there are a lot of areas, and particularly relating to the police culture, the organizational culture, that carried on through. So, for example, a very strong deference to the rank you hold. People do not debate issues in the police across ranks. The most senior person in the room is the one who gives orders. Everybody else just listens. So it's always had quite a militaristic, hierarchical culture. There's quite a strong code of silence. Police officials don't like to talk about their work they do. They don't like to have outsiders or people who are not part of the organization watching what they're doing, being involved in policing activities, unless they know that they're really strong supporters of the police. So those kinds of dynamics around the organizational culture have continued into the South African Police Service, but they also organizational dynamics that are quite commonly found in police organizations around the world. So they're very difficult to change. And I think that's where one area where the police reform is as successful as it was in many ways. We did see big improvements in people's trust in the police, more people using the police in the early days of democracy post-apartheid. So in the first, say, 5 to 10 years, we definitely saw improvements in people's willing to engage and perceptions of the police before we sort of reached a plateau in the kind of mid-2000s.
Mm. And what role does political pressure play in how the police respond to protests today? Are we seeing maybe a deeper systemic issue, or is it more about the leadership in power?
Well, indeed, policing everywhere in the world is to some extent, more or less, depending on the political culture, an expression of the political elites who have the most power in that society.
Yeah.
So it is the president in South Africa, for example, who appoints the National Commissioner of Police. The Minister of Police has quite a lot of control, a lot of ability to influence what the police does, all the way through to operational decisions making and personnel decisions and that kind of thing.
Mm.
So when the police are typically seen by a large proportion of the public as, you know, quite brutal, not very open, not very professional, it's usually an indication that the political elites are using that organization more for their own political interests than to really pursue what are commonly the constitutional interests or values that have been commonly publicly expressed, or the police's own codes of conduct and values. It doesn't mean that there aren't police officers or that many police officers in the organization don't solidly believe in that and really want to help people and are trying to do so under difficult conditions. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking at a systemic level, and we see that most people do not trust the police, most people have got a negative perception of the police because there's high levels of corruption, high levels of brutality, high levels of disinterest, police are not seen as professional, that's usually an indication that those with the most power to change and improve policing are not that interested in doing so.
And I think despite numerous reports and inquiries into police violence, there seems to be little change in accountability, in terms of accountability. Like, have you, in your assessment, have you seen maybe accountability in terms of when police have been using force and what can be done to address this?
Unfortunately, I think in South Africa, police misconduct is really characteristic by lack of accountability, very, very low levels of accountability. This doesn't mean that police officers who do bad things, who break the law, commit corruption, are not always held accountable. The South African Police Service has its own anti-corruption unit, for example, that arrests between 250 and 300 police officers every year for corruption. Last year, for what the figures we have, over 500 police officers were dismissed from the South African Police Service for various reasons, often to do with misconduct. So it's not as if there's absolutely no or zero accountability. But if you look at the size of the organization, we're talking about almost 185,000 people. So those 400 to 500 that get dismissed a year is a very small proportion of what is a much bigger problem of corruption and misconduct. Mm. So it is a problem that most police officials involved in crime, corruption, brutality do get away with it. And we've seen very, very little uptake of any of the recommendations from any of the commissions of inquiries, panel of experts and other boards that have looked into policing in the last 30 years really being taken seriously and properly implemented so that we see a substantial improvement in police accountability. There's been very little improvement for many years now.
Mm. Okay, Gareth, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
So now we're joined by Dr. Dane McKinley, an activist and political analyst who will help us connect the dots between state violence, economic inequality, and neoliberal policies. Dale's insights will help us shed light on how repression protects the economic elite while stifling social change. Dr. Dale, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Your work critiques the role of the state violence in protecting economic power. Can you explain how state repression is linked to neoliberalism and the concentration of wealth in South Africa?
Sure. So I think we have to, it's not specific to our contemporary situation, but if you go back to the pre-1994 days, basically what we can see is that the state's coercive capacity, in other words, the ability to repress and to control society through oftentimes violent means, including the army, the police, security services, and other kinds of things, has always been crucial to maintaining social and political control and order. It was the case in the apartheid era, and unfortunately, it has been the case in a different way in the democratic era. The most important thing, I think, to understand in our context in South Africa is to understand that when we had the transition to democracy, one of the key areas that really didn't transform very much, it transformed in terms of its racial composition, i.e. mostly white officers were replaced with black officers in the army and the police and the state. But the functions of those entities didn't really change much. The purpose that didn't change. So what happened fairly quickly after 94 is when the state faced demonstrations, when they faced anger from the community over, for example, service delivery problems, when the neoliberal gear program was implemented in the late 1990s and you started having people's electricity cut off and water cut off and evictions from their houses and losing their jobs and so forth, what you had was you had people responding on the streets. You had large demonstrations from the unions, from civic organizations, communities. And what did the state do? Instead of really engaging those people and engaging those organizations and trying to find out, they defaulted to what the previous state did, which was to try to repress, to try to delegitimize and repress. And that leads to violence. It leads oftentimes on the part of the state. It's not people who come out to try to create violent confrontations. It's often the police and the security services that do this. And what we've seen over the last 30 years is we've seen the state deploy these resources in defense of its policies, in defense of its, instead of saying, no, we're wrong, we need to change, we need to fundamentally shift our economic policies, we need to move away from privatization, we need to move away from austerity politics, we need all the neoliberal kinds of policies, they have chosen to try to basically suppress or to delegitimize the dissent. And that has led to, as we've seen, whether that's Marikana, whether that has been the different kinds of protests all across our country, we've seen this play itself out. So I think that's the context within which we can understand the connection between state violence, the use of the coercive forces, the neoliberal policies, and dissent and opposition in our society.
And in terms of economic justice, what are the deeper implications of a state that uses force to suppress protest?
Well, I think one of the first socioeconomic political implications is that what it does is it tells the society, it sends a message that there's not inclusivity. There's not a willingness to listen. There's not a willingness to consult people. It's basically, it's either you listen to us and when you don't, well, then we're going to deal with you. And that context and then creates further conflict in society. So it's not just the violence that might result from a demonstration or a strike or whatever it is, but the way the policing happens, the way that you create law and order, you can see it in the townships. You can see it where the police have become a feared force. They're not friends of the people anymore. They're not people who people turn to protect their communities. They are considered to either be people that will create violent situations, will not respond to your needs, or themselves are involved in nefarious activities, as we have often seen with the security forces. So I think it creates distrust amongst the people in the state. It creates more conflict as well. And it creates a general politics that says the way that we resolve our problems is through confrontation and violence. It's not through sitting down and negotiating and talking and creating democratic spaces and listening to each other. And I think that's a really negative long-term impact, besides the more immediate potential injuries, loss of life, destruction of property, whatever the case might be. But the violence then becomes sort of, it almost seeps through the body politic. And you see this, it becomes sort of a default position, where it's not just the security force of the state, but people themselves start dealing with each other violently. And we can see this in our statistics with regards to gender-based violence, with regards to community violence, where we are a society that often turns to that as the first response, as opposed to talking and dialoguing.
Mm. So what needs to change? My last question, Doc, what needs to change in terms of governance to address the systemic inequality in South Africa? And how does this tie into the need for police reform?
Yeah, I think the first part of that question is a big one, which is that in order to change the kinds of policies we have, we need a new political class. We need new representatives that are willing to listen to the people, that are accountable, not political parties that get voted in and then basically turn their back on their own constituents. And that's going to take a mobilization. It's not going to just be, okay, we create another party, but mobilization of people. If we go back to the 1980s, we go back to the time when civic organizations, church organizations, women, youth, all the different ones were powerful, it means we must mobilize and organize. And we've become weak as a society doing that. We've got a good responses oftentimes to immediate needs, but we don't have a long-term perspective of saying we need to build people's movements in order to change the political situation in our country. So I think it's about deepening democracy. It's about deepening our civic involvement. It's about people understanding that voting every 5 years is not the end of democracy. It's making sure that those that you elect and those that you have to represent you are carrying out the policies that you need. So it's about maturing our democracy. I think that we are still a very young democracy, and that's needed, and people taking that seriously. That's a longer term challenge. But in how that then will impact in terms of going forward, relating to the use of, I think what we, if the more that we are able to break down the barriers of socioeconomic equality, the more we're able to integrate our communities, the more that we're able to talk to each other, the less conflict and violence we're going to have. This is always the case. So we have to still deal with the legacies of apartheid. We still have to deal with the legacies of spatial planning, where people live in different communities according to their color, for the most part, and the class now, and breaking the integrated developments in the cities and the rural land reform and redistribution, all the things that people have been fighting and struggling for, but we've been very slow to implement in this country. Mm. These kinds of things and moving towards that and creating the spaces and the places that we can start talking and dialoguing together and living together and socializing together, that is the longer term solution to the use of violence. Because once you do that, you don't you then have a situation where people themselves are taking control, as opposed to the state responding to what people are doing.
Mm. And when we speak about people mobilizing, I think, I don't know, there is some fatigue that I think South Africans have. We don't want to take things to the street. We are afraid, even if there is there's a political party that says, let's go to the street and let's protest, still, even though they know they are suffering and they want justice, we still don't want to take action. What would you say about that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree that we say we don't want to take action, but I would say that I would agree with you to say that there is a fatigue. People have been, I think people are tired because of having to fight every day just for survival. We're talking about, you know, a situation where people are every day just trying to scrape by. So and this is why I say that it's not the answer to this is not just, oh, let's establish another political party and vote for that one, and then the leaders end up doing exactly the same thing. It's going to take us, and I think this is where the youth come in, because it's always the younger people. We saw it in the past during Soweto. We saw it in the 1980s. It's the youth that are going to drive this process because it's their future. And when you start looking at your future, if you're 20 years old or something and you look at the future, it doesn't look very good on a range of different fronts. It's not just about the politicians. It's about our environment. It's about our climate. It's about our basic services, our infrastructure, the violence in our society. So in this case, I think it's not an answer, but I think the instance of the youth basically saying, we are going to come together and start mobilizing, and we're going to start making people pay attention. We're going to make the politicians pay attention to us. We're going to force them to listen to us. Unfortunately, that's where it's come to. This has always been the catalyst for change. In the past, it was to get past the apartheid system. It has been to get past a range of different authoritarian and restrictive policies that have been implemented not only in our country, but elsewhere. So I think this is a long-term challenge, but I have every optimism. I'm a very optimistic that I think the youth in our country and the younger people are going to understand and realize eventually that if they do not act, their futures are going to be very, very negative and very dark. So it's up to them. And that's the thing. It's not just about voting for a political party. It's in your own self-interest, your community's interest, your family's interest to start acting and to speaking out. And it's always been the case. I think we're just in a period right now where people are a bit tired and wanting to sort of see where things are going. But I have no doubt that this is going to come back and is going to make for some serious systemic changes.
Okay, Doc, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. A big thank you to Shenila Mohammed, Gareth Newham, and Dr. Dale McKinley for sharing their insights. Thank you all for tuning in. I am Bulelani Nonyukela. Until next time, remember you can listen to our other podcasts, The SL Cabinet, She's Alive, and The Indigenous Corner. Goodbye.